This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Christians and Jews have much in common. Both believe in the words of the Old Testament. They also have an historical figure in common, Jesus. But the understanding followers of these two major faiths have of the Old Testament and of Jesus can be wildly out of sync. Dr. Amy Jill Levine grew up Jewish in a mostly Catholic neighborhood, and that is where her fascination for all of this began. Today, she's a professor of New Testament and Jewish studies at Vanderbilt University's Divinity School, has written several books about Jesus, about the New Testament, and about misunderstandings of Jesus as a Jew. She's a scholar in residence with Temple Emmanuel in Gastonia, and while she's here, we decided to pick her brain a bit about the great divide between two religions that share so much. You were here in 2000, so welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
What took you so long to come back? Somebody, was it something I said?
Oh, darling, I was just waiting for the invitation.
I'll bet you were. Well, thank you for being here. You, as I said, you grew up Jewish in Massachusetts.
Yes.
In a Catholic neighborhood, and now you've turned out to be a professor of New Testament at a divinity school in the Bible Belt, and you attend an Orthodox Jewish synagogue. There seems to be a disconnect here somewhere. I'm not sure where. Why does an Orthodox Jew have such a great interest in the New Testament?
Yes, well, I should say I'm not actually an Orthodox Jew. The level of my orthodoxy is really quite low. I'm perfectly happy to have shrimp wrapped in bacon, and should you wish to take me out for lunch after, that would be just fine. But I am a member of an Orthodox congregation because I love the congregation. I like the Talmud study. I like the liturgy. I like the worship experience. I like the fact that my services run for 3+ hours on Saturday morning. And I actually don't have to do anything because I don't have pulpit privileges as a woman in an Orthodox synagogue. So for me personally, I'm disenfranchised from precisely what I don't want to do.
That answered part of my question. Yeah. But if you're not going to keep kosher and you and several other things that Orthodox Jews would do because mm-hmm. it's a matter of course in their faith, why be Orthodox? Why not be Reform or Conservative or something else?
Because I love the congregation.
Okay.
And I love the worship experience. I love the in-depth knowledge that the people in my synagogue have about their own tradition. And, you know, could we all be better at our particular religious affiliations? Sure. But at least Judaism allows me to be comfortable where I am. And at least the congregation is happy when I show up at services.
And you, this began, this interest in religion and this attraction toward a faith system began at a very young age in you. And it wasn't just for Judaism. It was for Christianity as well. Where did that come from, do you think, in you? What was it about religion that, because a lot of young people, 7 years old, 8 years old, mm-hmm. it's a chore to sit in the congregation and listen to this old guy drone on and on and on. Where did that come from in you?
Oh, I always found it fascinating. Going to worship services, whether accompanying my friends to Mass or going to my own synagogue, which was a conservative synagogue in Massachusetts, I just thought it was magical. There was something about people coming together and somehow all knowing exactly what to say at the right time, you know, whether it was in Hebrew in the synagogue or in Latin in the Mass, because I'm old enough to remember the Latin Mass, where people felt sustained and encouraged and inspired. I'm also interested in accessories, and my gosh, religion is fabulous when it comes to wearing interesting clothing that one would not wear on a normal basis.
Right.
I thought nuns were the coolest thing in the world because they had these great habits. I thought that priests had to wear special collars to keep them from lying. I still think that's actually a very good idea, since that's why one would wear a clerical collar. I thought prayer shawls were really interesting. So it was a way that we Americans had of being somehow distinct from the culture, mm-hmm. of saying we're taking some time out to be something other than what we would be on a normal work day, and that was what worship was. What's not to like about Christmas with the tree and Santa and tinsel and things like stars that stop directly over somebody's house and you don't get incinerated? So all of this Christian holiday celebration, liturgical celebration, just sounded and looked beautiful, miraculous, inspirational.
Through the eyes of a child, but yeah. Children have parents, and parents generally, if you grow up in a faith tradition, are generally immersed in that faith tradition. Otherwise, they don't take their kids to synagogue or to church. Yours did, mm-hmm. but you told your mother at some point that you were going to go to church with your friends. You were going to go to catechism classes with your friends. Catechism is religious education in the Catholic mm-hmm. Church. And she said, okay.
I was blessed with fabulous parents. And my parents explained to me that Judaism and Christianity were actually very, very similar, that we worship the same God, the one who created heaven and earth, that we took authority from the same set of scriptures, what the church called the Old Testament and what we called the Tanakh, because Jews used the term Old Testament since we don't have a new one, mm-hmm. That we prayed the same prayers, most notably the Psalms, and that the church thought a Jewish man named Jesus was really important. So my initial sense was Christianity was kind of like Judaism. The church was like the synagogue we didn't go to. So it was all part of the same system. I was also intrigued by the Catholic system particularly. I do remember at the time when Pope John the 23rd died, and I was still a child, coming home from school, and the only thing that was on television back when there were still just three stations was the funeral of John the 23rd. And I said to my mother, why are we watching this and I'm not watching afternoon cartoons? And my mother said to me, this is the funeral of Pope John the 23rd. He was good for the Jews. You should watch this. This is important. So I remember sitting down with my mother and watching. And what did I learn about the Pope? He lived in Italy, which to me meant you got to eat spaghetti, and that was all good. He got to ride around in a car and stand up. He had this great crown. He wore white. I look good in white. And he's good for the Jews. So I announced to my mother, well, when I grow up, I'm going to be the Pope because, you know, you live in Italy and you eat spaghetti and it's good for the Jews. And my mother said, you can't be the Pope. And I said, why not? And she said, because you're not Italian. So,
that was pretty close back then.
Yeah, it was pretty close. I'm actually still in the running. I've worked with the Italian Bishops Conference. And I suggested prior to the last conclave, look, when you go in, if you could just write my name on the first ballot, it's going to go up in smoke anyway, but it'll make me feel good.
You mentioned that your mom said that Pope John the 23rd was good for the Jews.
Yeah.
Why was he good for the Jews?
He was the one who developed what we today now know as Vatican II.
Right.
And one of the last documents of Vatican II is a text called Nostra Aetate, Latin for In Our Time. And this text insists that Jews at all times and all places cannot be held responsible for the death of Jesus. And this actually creates a sea change in Catholic religious education, and then Protestant churches in general followed suit and said, no, that there should not be some sort of generational blood guilt where every Jew should be looked at as a Christ killer. And that creates a sea change in Catholic thought regarding Judaism. And we've seen the fruits of that change over the past 60 years or so, where Jewish-Christian relations have so much improved. And the reason they've improved substantially is because the church said to the Jewish community, we've not treated you like neighbors. We've not treated you like sisters and brothers. We repent of how we've acted in the past. Let's have conversation. And the reason we Jews have been able to engage better in Jewish-Christian relations is because our Christian neighbors have said it's time to do so.
You have a personal experience with the feeling of some Christians prior to John the 23rd's admonishment that Jews cannot be held responsible for the death of Jesus. You have a personal experience with that as a child.
It's true. When I was in second grade, I became completely enamored of Catholic tradition regarding First Holy Communion, mm-hmm. because I didn't know what the ritual was, but all of my friends got the bride dress with the matching shoes and the veil. So again, the accessories alone make this a worthwhile initiation, right?
And the dress was white.
Oh, yeah.
You look good in white.
Right. This is good. It's almost worth getting married more than once. So I announced to my parents I needed to make my first Holy Communion, and they said, you can't because you're Jewish. And I said, but wait a minute, it's the same God and the same Bible. They said, forget it. the closest I came was my mother bought my Barbie doll a bride dress, and I used to practice giving communion to Barbie. We used Necco wafers, I recall.
As one would.
As one would, absolutely. Because who knew you could actually use matzah? About midway through that school year, a little girl said to me on the school bus, "You killed our Lord." And I remember saying with no small degree of indignation, "No, I did not." And she said, "Yes, you did. Our priest said so." All right. So therefore, it had to be true. I get off the school bus. I'm crying hysterically. And my mother says, "What's wrong?" And I said, "I killed God," because I was convinced that I had, because the priest said so. And she said, it took her a while to figure out exactly what happened on the bus. This is not quite what's supposed to happen in second grade. Once she figured out what happened, she assured me that God was doing just fine, which I took to be an enormous relief. And she made a few calls to the local diocesan office, the Catholic education office. Mm-hmm. The priest was reprimanded. And then comes Vatican II. So I couldn't figure out how this tradition that had, you know, the bunny and Santa and the same God and the same scriptures and all this wonderful stuff was saying horrible things about me. Yeah. So I said, "I'm going to catechism with my friends. I'm going to find out where this hateful teaching came from, and I'm going to stop it. I'm 7 years old, and I'm going to end anti-Semitism." And now I'm 57, so I've been at this a long time. And the fascination is still there. And the wonderful thing is that with very few exceptions, I've not encountered that type of unfortunate teaching. Yeah.
Well, that teaching comes from the New Testament, a book that you seem to be fascinated with as a Jewish person. It comes from Matthew 27:25, where Pontius Pilate washes his hands before the crowd and essentially says that I'm not responsible, I'm innocent of this man's blood, it's on your head. And the mob responds, I don't know how a mob does this in unison with the same words, but the mob responds, "His blood be on us and on our children." And so some Christians, as Catholics, took that to mean for years and years, centuries actually, mm-hmm. that the Jews accepted responsibility for killing Jesus. Mm-hmm. Why is that not the case, if that's what it says in Matthew 27:25?
Well, as you just pointed out, that's a somewhat odd thing for an entire group of people to say.
They could have just said, yeah.
Yeah, all right. And it is only in Matthew. But it is also the case that there are other documents in the New Testament that also lay the charge of killing Jesus at the feet of the Jews mm-hmm. And completely exculpate the Romans as if it's not their problem. I mean, we find it in Paul's first epistle to the Thessalonians, where Paul says, "The Jews who killed the Lord Jesus and oppose all people." So we've got hints of it elsewhere, and the Gospel of John is not really good in terms of making nice to the Jewish population. The early church had a problem. Followers of Jesus, both Jewish and Gentile, because the original followers are all Jews like Jesus himself is, couldn't fathom why the majority of the Jewish community did not accept Jesus as Lord and Savior, because it was abundantly obvious to them mm-hmm. that he was. Mm-hmm. And they had to figure out various explanations as to what happened. Paul, Jewish himself and a Pharisee, said, "Well, wait a minute. A hardening has come upon Israel so that the Gentiles can come in." In other words, this is all sort of set up by God. And eventually all Israel will be saved. And Matthew says, "Well, it's a problem where the Jewish leaders misled the population." And John says, in effect, they're children of the devil and they weren't going to get it anyway. So the church, more interested in Jews, puts the blame on the Jews.
Dr. Amy Jill Levine, a professor of New Testament and Jewish Studies at Vanderbilt University Divinity School and a scholar in residence at Temple Emmanuel in Gastonia. We'll continue in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Brick's Wood-Fired Pizza, featuring a new mobile pizza kitchen which cooks Brick's signature brick oven pizzas on-site for holiday and private parties, corporate luncheons, and community events. Details at brickscatering.com. And Donald Hack Diamonds, serving Charlotte for over 30 years with fine diamonds, engagement rings, custom design, and jewelry for all occasions. Donald Hack Diamonds, Sharon Road across from South Park Mall, and donaldhack.com. Everybody knows the music of Vince Guaraldi, even if you don't know his name, because he's the man who has the music behind all those Peanuts specials on television, and we really hear him at this time of year. But there are a group of Charlotte's musicians who think you ought to get to know Vince Guaraldi and his music a little better, and they're putting on a show next week at the Booth Playhouse, next Tuesday night, to explore this prolific jazz musician, pianist, composer's music, and we'll meet some of them tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm show, there's widespread agreement that our government is not working well. Legal scholars debate the causes of dysfunction in Washington and how the U.S. Constitution plays a role.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks. Here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Dr. Amy Jill Levine from Vanderbilt University, and also as scholar in residence. She's also with Temple Emmanuel in Gastonia. Tonight, she is talking about Jesus, Judaism, and Jewish-Christian relations at 7 at Unity Place, St. Stephen's AME Zion Church in Gastonia. And you can find more information about that at our website, wfae.org/charlottetalks. You had this interest in Christianity early on in your Jewish life and have gone on to become a PhD and teaching at a divinity school, and you teach New Testament. Mm-hmm. What has your study and understanding of the New Testament done to, for, I'm not even sure what the preposition would be, your faith in Judaism?
It's helped not so much in terms of the faith, but more in terms of the understanding of the history and the ethics and the practice. Because Jewish faith is itself remarkably diverse. One can, in fact, be Jewish and be an atheist, because technically one is Jewish if one's mother is Jewish, or in the Reform movement, if either parent is Jewish and you're raised as a Jewish household. In that sense, Judaism never settled down just to be a religion based on faith. It always kept that ethnic component. But what I find in studying the New Testament is I get parts of Jewish history coming back to me. We Jews in our own educational program are very good up to the holiday of Hanukkah, which we're currently celebrating, and that's in the second century before the time of Jesus. And then suddenly, miraculously, we're over in the Mishnah, this beginning of the compendium of Jewish law, which was written down in the year 200. So if I want to know something about Judaism in the first century, along with the Jewish historian Josephus, the New Testament's one of my best sources. And as we were talking about last night at Belmont Abbey, if I want to know something about Jewish women's lives in antiquity, the New Testament is my best source.
Really?
Yeah.
So do you view the New Testament as a religious tract, or do you view it more as a book of history, a history book that gives you a window into that first century world?
Yeah, why does it have to be an either or? It's clearly a religious book. It's the foundation document of the Christian church. But it's also a book of history, because religion and history are not mutually exclusive.
Mm-hmm. But as a Jew, how do you view it?
I view it as a religious text for my Christian brothers and sisters. And therefore, it deserves the respect that a religious text deserves. But it is not authoritative religiously for me.
And that's my question, I guess. Why not? Because as you study it, as a PhD, as you study this, as you teach it to others, and you teach it mostly to Christian young people, I'm sure, it has not swayed you.
No, it hasn't. And that, I think the question of how come I study so much, why haven't I become convinced by that? Mm-hmm. I think that's basically a category confusion. It's presuming that religion is based on academics. It's not. Religious faith is more like love than it's like doing the Times crossword puzzle or filling out a Sudoku. It's not based on logic. It's not based on argument. It's based on grace. It's based on what your heart tells you is the case rather than what your head tells you. Mm-hmm. In that sense, it's like love.
You mentioned that one of the reasons for this misunderstanding that we've had for centuries about Christians believing that the Jews killed Jesus was that the early Christians could not fathom why certain people in their own faith, the Jewish tradition, did not accept Jesus as Messiah, as Lord, mm-hmm. as Lord and Savior. And so they had to come up with reasons for this, and that was one of the reasons that they came up with. why didn't everybody in the Jewish tradition of the time see Jesus the same way? Were the only people that saw him that way the people that met him, walked with him, spoke with him?
Oh, no. And we know from the book of Acts and from various other historians at the time that other Jews, after the proclamation of Jesus' resurrection, did join that early movement, what we eventually call the church. But the majority of Jews do not, and the Jesus movement goes to the Gentile world, the pagan world, very, very quickly. The majority of Jews who were expecting a Messiah to come, and not all were, associated the Messiah with the Messianic Age. So when the Messiah came, so thought most Jews, there would be a general resurrection of the dead. Everybody would come back. There would be a final judgment. There would be an end to war and death and disease and poverty. It would be the kingdom of heaven, mm-hmm. as Jesus phrases it. And that didn't happen. So what the followers of Jesus did is detach the coming of the Messiah from the Messianic Age and explain that Jesus would come back. So that when the church talks about the second coming, that's kind of like what Jews traditionally say. That's the coming of the Messiah. It's the time when God's justice finally prevails. Mm-hmm. Jews said, the Messianic Age is not here, ergo, Jesus cannot be the Messiah.
Mm-hmm. We've had several people on from the Jesus Seminar over the past 15 years on this program many times, and most of them have said, if not all of them, that Jesus never said he was the Messiah, never referred to himself as the Son of God, never referred to himself as a Savior.
Yes. Well,
have you found any evidence of that in your studies?
Well, I'm not a member of the Jesus Seminar, but the founder of the seminar, Robert Funk, used to teach at Vanderbilt, and I have his old office.
Oh.
And I think they're a little bit too skeptical. There are actually parts in the New Testament where Jesus does acknowledge his messianic role, mm-hmm. And the Jesus Seminar says, no, Jesus never really said that. That was added in by his followers later.
Yeah, we should point out that they've gone through the New Testament, and they have color-coded it with phrases that Jesus absolutely said, phrases that he may have said, and phrases that he absolutely did not say.
Yeah, and it's about as precise as that. Yeah, don't think so. Could be possible. Pretty sure. Nah, not at all. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that Jesus, as I understand him historically, felt that he had a commission from God, that he had a special and intimate relationship with God. I think he was a visionary. He may well have been a mystic. I think he was a healer. I think there were other healers at the time as well. He's certainly not the only one. And I think he may well have thought that it was his role to prepare his people, the Jewish people, for the inbreaking of the kingdom of God. And that's a perfectly good definition of the time of what a Messiah would do.
Most Jewish people have probably not, correct me if I'm wrong, have probably not read the New Testament. It's not on their bookshelf.
It's not on the bookshelf, you know, unless they went into a hotel and picked up a copy, mm-hmm. Or took a course in the New Testament. But Oxford University Press did publish in 2011 a volume called The Jewish Annotated New Testament. This is a personal plug because I edited it with Mark Brettler of Brandeis University.
The Pope has a copy.
The Pope does have a copy,
yeah.
Which I think is great. And I wish he would get it into the hands of everybody, every priest and religious educator. 51 separate Jewish commentators doing annotations for every book in the New Testament. And then back essays on, you know, who were the Pharisees and what was the temple and how have Jews looked at Jesus over the past 2,000 years and how have Jews looked at Paul, to recognize that it's about time we Jews actually knew this material, not only because it's part of our history as well, but when people do say unfortunate and anti-Jewish things, then we can go to the text itself and say, wait a minute, here's actually what it says.
Yeah. You actually point out that the New Testament is a book substantially about Jews, written by Jews, attesting to Jewish practices and beliefs. So what would you say to those Jews out there who have not read it? I mean, what will they glean from this? What will they take away?
A multitude of things. I think if we want to be culturally competent in the 21st century, then it behooves us to know the origins of such phrases as good Samaritan and turning the other cheek and prodigal son, or the beast whose number is 666. I mean, the New Testament gives us this. I think if we're interested in questions of morality, ethics, how we get along with people, then Jesus, particularly in his parables and in the Sermon on the Mount, has wisdom that's not restricted to the Christian church.
Where did that come from in him? If it didn't come from the Old Testament, because he was a Jew, if those lessons did not come from that experience, where did they come from? Or maybe they did come from that experience.
I think they do come from that experience. And then Jesus, good Jew that he is, takes his tradition and says, what does this mean for people today? Mm-hmm. In the same way that anybody giving a sermon, whether in the synagogue or in a church, would say, here's what my scriptures tell me. Here's how today I might actualize them.
So many Christians see the New Testament as canceling out the Old Testament. And they still read the Old Testament. They understand the lessons. But the New Testament is an addendum. It is a course correction, essentially, whereas the God of the Old Testament is mean and violent. The God of the New Testament is loving and accepting and all-embracing. But there are echoes of the Old Testament in the New. That's what you're saying, right?
But it's more than that. So at the risk of contradicting my host...
Go right ahead.
Thank you, and do invite me back.
You won't be the first, then you won't be the last. Go ahead.
To look at the Old Testament as proclaiming a God of wrath and the New Testament as proclaiming a God of love is just very, very selective reading. It's the Old Testament that gives me, the Lord is my shepherd who leads me beside still waters and restores my soul. And it's the New Testament that gives me the book of Revelation where God destroys the world 1 1/3 times if you actually count it up. It's the same God. And if someone wants to make the proclamation that somehow God had a personality transplant somewhere in the early Hellenistic period, that's actually a Christian heresy. It's called Marcionism, and it's bad theology. And it bears false witness against both the scriptures of Israel and the Jewish community that looks at that as our basis. But we're all interpreting that earlier material. So the church reads the Old Testament through the lens of the New Testament, and the Jewish community reads the Tanakh, our Old Testament, through the lenses of rabbinic literature. So we're always interpreting. The religion doesn't stay stagnant, and none of us is practicing the religion of ancient Israel, whether it's Abraham or Moses. We're always interpreting that text.
So if a Jew today who's never read the New Testament gets a copy and starts to read it, through what lens would they be interpreting it?
That Jew's individual lens, because it's not as if all Jews think the same way. Mm-hmm. And ideally, for the Jew who reads the New Testament, whether Matthew or Paul or Revelation, the Jew would then start talking to Christian neighbors and saying, how do you understand this text? Or how do Catholics understand it? Or Lutherans? Or Baptists? Or members of the Church of Christ? So we recognize that we have a basic text that underlies the church, mm-hmm. but then Christians have, in myriad ways, interpreted that text very, very differently.
And from a point of view of a Jewish person, you say that the New Testament preserves part of Jewish history that the Jews don't have, mm-hmm. including Jesus, Mary Magdalene, Jesus' mother, James, Paul. They're all Jews. Oh. But why would they matter to Jews?
For some Jews, they certainly don't. And some Jews have absolutely no interest in this material. For me, as an historian, I'm interested in the various options that the Jewish people had, with Christianity, the followers of Jesus, being one option, and Rabbinic Judaism being another, and the Dead Sea Scrolls representing a third, and the followers of John the Baptist representing a fourth. So I'm interested in the diversity of what makes Jewish history and Jews, Jews, in the same way I'm interested in what makes us Americans and how did our government take shape and what were the various options. So it fills in our history. I also think for Jews, if we Jews want our Christian neighbors to respect us as Jews, that means knowing a little bit more than Adam Sandler's Hanukkah song and we're concerned about Israel and there were some problems during World War II, right? It means knowing our ethics and our traditions. Then I think we owe Christians the same courtesy.
You mentioned, and I took this quote from you, that the New Testament's a book substantially about Jews, written by Jews, attesting to Jewish practices and beliefs. Mm-hmm. But was it written by Jews? Because how many of the people who wrote the New Testament or chapters or passages in the New Testament no longer consider themselves Jewish? They were Christians.
Except the term Christian doesn't show up very often in the New Testament. I mean, Paul never refers to himself as a Christian, and Paul's clearly a Jew. He's a Pharisee, and Paul's actually very proud of his Jewish background. And then he says, you know, but as proud as I am of that, it all takes a second place to the Jesus tradition. Most biblical scholars think Matthew is writing out of a Jewish environment, think the Gospel of John is writing out of a Jewish environment. Mm-hmm. And they're, whether they call themselves Jews or not, they're all struggling over the legacy of Israel. Who is the correct heir of Abraham? Who is the correct interpreter of Moses? What does God want us to do, and how do we understand our own tradition?
So many places to go with this. I'm not sure where to go with it at any given time. But Jesus was a Jew. He was not a Christian.
I'm not even sure he knew the term.
And the New Testament, you're saying, is written by Jews. So are we, from as an historical tract, are we seeing the world of that time and the places that are written about and the events that are written about then through the eyes of a first century Jewish person? Is that the point of view that we're getting throughout?
In some cases, we're also getting material through the eyes of people who are not Jewish. I don't think the person who wrote the Gospel of Luke was Jewish. I have my doubts about whether the person who wrote the Gospel of Mark was Jewish. And the Gospels come to us originally anonymously. The names are added on later. I'm pretty sure the fellow who wrote the book of Revelation was Jewish, but I'm not really sure I want to claim him as one of ours because I find this a somewhat dangerous book. But we're getting various Jewish views in the first century in the same way that we're getting various views about how Jesus' followers understood him. The church, in its wisdom, gives us four Gospels with four quite different personalities accorded to Jesus.
There were other Gospels, allegedly, that have disappeared or been expunged from the record by early Christianity. Do you believe that?
Well, we know that they exist, so it's not just allegedly. Okay. We have them. We have the Gospel according to Thomas, which is kind of like Jesus' greatest hits. It's got no plot line. It's basically Jesus said something really interesting or mystifying or inspirational. We've got the Gospel according to Mary. We recently put together the Gospel.
Mary, the mother of Jesus?
Well, we don't know.
Okay.
It's the problem. I mean, half the women in the New Testament are named Mary.
Yeah.
So probably Mary Magdalene, okay. Probably. The Gospel according to Judas. Which has just finally been reconstructed from a bunch of fragments. So we have a number of these ancient texts. Whether they were actually in the running to be part of the canon and then got expunged, or whether they were second and third century materials that no one fully looked at as having the same authority that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John have, that's a question scholars debate.
And those decisions about which books should be included in the New Testament as a whole were made by what, the early first or second, third century Catholic Church?
Well, we can't even talk about the Catholic Church at this point. We have a number of individual congregations. And what we think happened is that those books that had the greatest popularity among the greatest number of people eventually landed in the New Testament canon. And most of the Gospels that did not make that canonical cut tend to be quite esoteric. They're difficult to understand. They're highly philosophical, and they're really not designed for popular consumption. They're designed for the elite.
Purposefully, or is that what the elite decided?
No, I think purposely. They are really, really hard to understand. And the other thing is that the Gospels in the New Testament give us a history of Jesus, and they give us the cross. These other Gospels don't.
We'll come back and talk about why that may be. Dr. Amy Jill Levine is our guest. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Youth Ballet presenting The Nutcracker tomorrow through Sunday at the Halton Theater. Details at charlotteyouthballet.org. And Mr. Rogers Windows, a locally family-owned business since 1986, offering renewal by Anderson replacement windows and entry door systems installed by trained craftsmen. Product details at mrrogerswindows.com. Well, there's widespread agreement that our government is not working well. Legal scholars debate the causes of dysfunction in Washington and how the U.S. Constitution plays a role. That's coming up in about 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. And if you have questions about what we're talking about this morning, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks is a great place to start. We're coming right back.
WFAE is here for you 24 hours a day, every day, all year long. We hope you're here for us as well, and that's why we're asking, if you've been listening and haven't contributed recently, now is the perfect time to do so. In addition to supporting the news and information you rely on, you'll be automatically entered in our contest to win the latest MacBook. Take the time now to support the best radio programming with one simple call at 704-549-9000 or register online at WFAE.org. The contest ends at midnight, December 31st.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Amy Jill Levine is our guest. She's a professor of divinity, professor of New Testament and Jewish studies at Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and the scholar in residence at Temple Emmanuel in Gastonia. She's also written many books, The Misunderstood Jew, The Church and the Scandal of the Jewish Jesus, The Historical Jesus in Context, the 14-volume Feminist Companions of the New Testament and Early Christian Writings, just to name a few. She will be speaking tonight at the AME Zion Church, St. Stephen's AME Zion Church in Gastonia at 7, and you can get to more info on that on our website, wfae.org/charlottetalks. We were talking about the other books of the New Testament that didn't make the cut. And you mentioned that the ones that do make the cut, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, mention the crucifixion, mention the cross. And the ones that didn't make the cut do not.
Generally
not. Why
not? Most of the Gospels that don't make the cut are interested in salvation based on knowledge. And the Greek term for knowledge is gnosis, and hence we have expressions like the Gnostic Gospels. Their idea is that if you just had the right teaching, if you just had the right key, you could save your soul, you could slough off the human body, which they looked at as a kind of degraded prison, and then your soul would emerge and unite with the great beyond and you'd be happy. Except the New Testament Gospels, which are here quite Jewish, look at the body as really important, so that the word, the divine agent, takes on human flesh with, you know, sweat glands and hair follicles and all the frailties of the body, because that's saying that's how important the body is. And it says that Jesus doesn't come back as what, Jesus the friendly ghost. He comes back with an empty tomb in bodily form, because it's salvation not by the knowledge that you have. It's salvation by the fidelity of Jesus, who's willing to follow his commission to the cross, and then who is raised by God. So the New Testament, the Gospels there, give us a quite different message than these Gospels that did not make the canonical cut.
Was it more important to the people of the time? Was it more impactful for the people of the time to have the crucifixion message as opposed to having this other esoteric kind of approach?
Well, it was certainly more important to the people who preserved the New Testament and eventually determined the canonicity.
So how do you determine the truth?
It was Pilate who says what is truth. That's a very dangerous question to ask. How do you know?
Are you asked by your students?
Frequently. Mm-hmm. Right after they say, is this on the exam? It's not my job to tell them what the truth is. It's my job to give them the critical tools by which they determine the truth for themselves, and not just for themselves as individuals, but the truth as they understand it within their own particular churches or synagogues or denominational view.
One of your goals, you say, is to educate Christians about early Judaism. And I also read that sometimes when they are exposed to that information, some Christians are set back on their heels. How so?
There are a number of misconceptions about early Judaism that have crept their way into the Christian church, and it comes from uninformed Sunday school teachers, pastors who might have missed a couple of lectures in their divinity school education, and just standard stereotypes, because human beings carry negative stereotypes about other groups. So views that first century Judaism represents the height of misogyny. They make the Taliban look progressive. And then Jesus comes along, kind of like Hillary Clinton, and says, equal rights for women and, by the way, free health care. That first century Judaism is entirely militaristic, and therefore the Jews rejected Jesus because he talked about peace. Or that all Jews in the first century are trying to pile up good deeds so that God will love them and they will earn a place into heaven. This is what Protestants sometimes call works righteousness, and Jesus invents grace. And all of that is just an incorrect reading of early Judaism. And I'm convinced that if we get Judaism wrong, we're going to get Jesus wrong.
Hmm. So when you expose young people who come from various different backgrounds and who only know they've been exposed to, I guess, Christianity primarily through their experience in a church, you're going to get very different points of view, are you not? Because they're all coming from slightly different faith backgrounds. And how do they accept this?
Of course. And it's also, by the way, not just young people. We have a number of second career people who are interested in coming into ministry. Mm-hmm. And the Divinity School takes students from, you know, the people just fresh from bachelor's degrees to folks in their 80s. So the experience that my students bring is really quite varied. And what I want to do is expose them to a variety of different views. And at the same time, I'm very well aware that just because a student identifies as Presbyterian or Lutheran or Episcopalian or Catholic, that doesn't necessarily mean that the student agrees with everything the church teaches.
Right.
I think at some point pretty much everybody sits uneasily in the pew and thinks, yeah, I'm not really sure I buy that. Let me look a little bit more closely. Because I do think that an unexamined religion is not a mature religion, and I believe that God gave us brains as well as hearts, and we ought to use those
that
brains.
That goes against the grain of a lot of strains of Christianity, where you don't really want to question anything. You take it for face value.
Yeah. Well, the disciples themselves questioned Jesus. I think that's a good thing. People in the churches have been questioning the meaning of the New Testament pretty much since it's been written, which is why we have all these different denominations, is because denominational leaders, whether Calvin or Luther or Stone Campbell or Wesley or the Magisterium of the Catholic Church, have said, we need to interpret this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So if we simply stay with a childhood, you know, Sunday school mentality, we're not treating the Bible as a document that's still alive and that's still speaking to us. And I think we're abdicating our own personal responsibility to get to know this text.
You mentioned the stereotypes that some Christians have of early Jews because they haven't studied it, and that's one of the things that you try to wake them up to. There must be stereotypes in the opposite directions that Jews have of Christians. What might they be?
Yes, because we're all bearing false witness against our neighbors. So that when I'm not working with Christian groups, disabusing them of their incorrect and negative stereotypes about Judaism, I'm working with Jews, disabusing them of their incorrect and negative stereotypes about Christianity. Like, all Christians need to do is believe in Jesus, and that's it. When the New Testament is abundantly clear, this is the Epistle of James in the New Testament, faith without works is dead. If you don't act on your faith in Christianity, it really doesn't count. So the concern that Christianity has for being present in the world and taking care of the poor and the hungry and the stranger and the person in prison, views that all Christians think that Jews are going to hell, when in fact many Christians don't. They recognize that Jews are also under covenant with God. Views that Christians are generally intolerant, when some of the most gracious, wonderful, pluralistic, ecumenical people you might find might be your Christian neighbor down the street. So we all have these unfortunate stereotypes. And it's a failure, I think, on our part, as the book of Leviticus says, to love our neighbors as ourselves.
We have several people who have emailed and Facebooked and tweeted, so I'm going to bring their questions to the table here. Jeremy in Kannapolis emails, history has compiled a list of time periods wherein religious beliefs have ignored and even persecuted discovery, progress, and diversity. How do we find a balance between traditions of exclusion and the diverse, globalized world of the future?
Ooh, how much time do we have? It's a wonderful question.
8 minutes.
We've not done very well over the past millennia of human existence in terms of being tolerant of diverse views. And even when it comes to that type of tolerance regarding science, sometimes I think we do let science get away from us, and then we engage in things like horrible and tragic medical experiments. So how do we do this? From my own sense, I take very seriously the book of Genesis, which I don't take to be a history book. I take it to be a book of, you know, instruction that helps us ask the right questions. If we begin with the view that everybody is in the image and likeness of God, then I cannot fully demonize anybody across the table, no matter how horrid that person's views or no matter how tragic that person's actions. So we have to figure out, how do we live together in community? And that's my rubric for how I do it.
David on Facebook, what is your guest's take on the concept of descendants of Jesus?
I think Jesus was a celibate. The New Testament portrays him as a bridegroom. That's actually a title he uses for himself, but he never gets around to becoming a husband. Most of the people surrounding him are apart from traditional families. We have women who were married who were with him, but their husbands are not. We know Peter is with him because Jesus heals Peter's mother-in-law. Peter has a wife, but we never meet the
wife. Put that into historical context, please. I mean, how unusual is that? How scandalous would that have been for married women leaving their husbands behind to follow Jesus, a single man? Mm-hmm. Put that into some context.
Yeah. Well, the scandal was to some extent mitigated by the fact that they're there with a number of other people, and the group was probably known to be a celibate group. Celibacy has a role in first century Judaism. We know that from the Dead Sea Scrolls. We know it from a Jewish philosopher from Egypt named Philo. But what happened in the church is the more the church in the second century and the third century talked about virginity and celibacy and continence, the more the synagogue said, get married, make babies. So in the first century, the idea of a celibate man with groups of other celibates living together with him was actually not completely anomalous. Philo of Alexandria describes a very similar group.
I will tread softly and very carefully into this area here, I think, but there are those who do believe that Jesus had descendants, that he did have a wife, and it could have been Mary Magdalene, and he did have children. And of course, I never heard of this until 5 years ago doing this program, so I was surprised by the idea of it, but it does open the door to the sexuality of Jesus.
Yes.
And that seems to be something that is simply not going to be entertained. Why? What is it about sex and Christianity?
Well, it's what is it about sex and human nature? So that pretty much all cultures or all religions come up with certain rules by which we would engage in forms of sexual expression. And that's something that's intimate in every sense of the term, and we want to regulate it. Why is it important? Because any sort of sexual law, sexual rubric, makes it clear that we're humans and we're not animals, that we can actually control our impulses, that we can determine that we might, in most religions, want to connect sexuality with love and with commitment. Mm-hmm. And I think these are very good things, which I keep telling my children, neither of whom are married. So that I think religion helpfully provides certain sexual rubrics. And when I think religion gets off track is when the only thing it seems to be discussing is with whom and when and how one engages in sexual expression, when the Bible itself is so much more interested in things like taking care of the poor and feeding people who are hungry and working for peace.
Why do you think we gravitate toward those sections as opposed to working for the poor and working toward peace? We're more concerned with who sleeps with whom and what the Bible says about it. Why?
Yes, we are. I think to some extent it's the fault of the media. I'm so sorry, she said, speaking on the radio.
It's always our fault. I'm used to it.
When it's either that or blaming your mother. I think because it's easier to regulate. And you know what? It's also cheaper, and it requires less work. It's easier to say, don't sleep with this person, than it is to figure out how to provide affordable health care to people. It's easier to say, this form of sexual expression is correct, and this form is wrong, than it is to try to cure poverty.
But if you're a true believer, are you cheating Jesus by taking that approach?
I don't think so. Jesus begins with the great commandment. It's love of God and love of neighbor. It seems to me that then we try to figure out how best do we love God and how best do we love neighbor. And when I look at what the biblical tradition from Genesis all the way through to Revelation says, it's not saying all that much about sexuality, but it really is saying a whole lot about justice. So if the Bible gives me percentage-wise, justice is more important than sex, I'm going to go with justice.
You're leaving out the whole baguette section, aren't you? I'm just kidding. Christy emails, so why do you call Paul a Pharisee?
because Paul calls himself a Pharisee. He says, as to the law, a Pharisee. The book of Acts describes Paul as having been educated by Gamaliel, who's actually a very well-known Pharisee in the first century. So Paul himself trots out his Pharisaic credentials. Whether after he began to follow Jesus, he still considers himself a Pharisee, that's unclear.
Dick in Statesville says, if this fits your discussion, could you ask Dr. Levine her thoughts on some words translated from the original Hebrew? Number one, righteous and righteousness, as the King James Version translates it, and any other familiar passages, for example, Psalm 23, that might have deeper meanings not fully captured in translations.
The term for righteousness in Hebrew, it comes from the root tzedek, and we can see that literally cashing out in the term tzedakah, which means charity. So in other words, how do you express your righteousness? You make sure that the poor are taken care of. It comes into Greek as dikaiosune, and we talk about the righteousness of God in reconciling humanity to divinity through the sacrifice of the Christ. So righteousness is it's not just an abstract category, it's how you act.
We've had Dr. James Tabor, who's a religious professor's study at UNC Charlotte, on this program a number of times. He's written a book about Paul, and in which he says that the contemporary Christian faith is really more Paulinity than it is Christianity, because it's his take. And you mentioned that the Jews, that there was a divide between the Jews who knew Jesus, the followers who knew Jesus, who walked with him, ate with him, and people like Paul who came along later. There's a divide. How are those two things melted together in 15 seconds or less?
Because the Pauline church is predominantly a Gentile church directed for people who were not Jews to begin with, and contemporary Christians are heirs of that Gentile church. But it's still on the basis of the teachings and actions and death of Jesus.
Dr. Amy Jill Levine, professor of New Testament and Jewish Studies at Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and scholar in residence at Temple Emmanuel in Gastonia. Thanks for coming back. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.